Illumination came from everywhere and nowhere. The walls scintillated. With a series of thumps and grunts and jingles, Verloc saw that he now carried the day's donated coins in a small burlap sack, chains came down and hopped to the floor beside him. He gave a quick tug to a rope tied to the ladder, and the false bed pallet fell back down and locked itself above. "There! Isn't this much nicer?"
"Yeah."
Locke ran one hand down the flawless surface of one of the walls. The glass was noticeably cooler than the air.
"It's elder glass, isn't it?"
"Sure as hell isn't plaster."
Chains shooed Locke along the passage to the left, where it turned a corner.
"The whole temple cellar is surrounded by the stuff, sealed in it. The temple above was actually built to settle into it, hundreds of years ago. There's not a break in it, as far as I can tell, except for one or two little tunnels that lead out to other interesting places. It's flood-tight, and never lets in a drop from below, even when the water's waist-deep in the streets, and it keeps out rats and roaches and suckle spiders and all that crap, so long as we mind our comings and goings." The clatter of metal pans and the low giggle of the Sansa brothers reached them from around the corner just before they turned it, entering into a comfortably appointed kitchen with tall wooden cabinets and a long witchwood table, surrounded by high-backed chairs. Locke actually rubbed his eyes when he saw their black velvet cushions and the varnished gold leaf that gilded their every surface. Carlo and Galdo were working at a brick cooking shelf, shuffling pans and banging knives over a huge white alchemical hearth slab. Locke had seen smaller blocks of this stone, which gave off a smokeless heat when water was splashed atop it, but this one must have weighed as much as Father Chain's. As Locke watched, Carlo, Galdo, held a pan in the air and poured water from a glass pitcher onto the sizzling slab. The great uprush of steam carried a deep bouquet of sweet cooking smells, and Locke felt saliva spilling down the back of his mouth. In the air over the witchwood table, a striking chandelier blazed. Locke would, in later years, come to recognize it as an armillary sphere, fashioned from glass with an axis of solid gold. At its heart shone an alchemical globe with the white bronze light of the sun. Surrounding this were the concentric glass rings that marked the orbits and precessions of the world and all her celestial cousins, including the three moons. At the outermost edges were 100 dangling stars that looked like spatters of molten glass, somehow frozen at the very instant of their outward explosions. The light ran and glimmered and burned along every facet of the chandelier, yet there was something wrong about it. It was as if the elder glass ceilings and walls were somehow drawing the light out of the alchemical sun, leavening it, weakening it, redistributing it along the full length and breadth of all the elder glass in this uncanny cellar. "Welcome to our real home, our little temple to the benefactor."
Chains tossed his bag of coins down on the table.
"Our patron has always sort of danced upon the notion that austerity and piety go hand in hand. Down here, we show our appreciation for things by appreciating, if you get me. Boys, look who survived his interview."
"We never doubted," said one twin.
"For even a second," said the other.
"But now can we hear what he did to get himself kicked out of Shade's Hill?"
The question, spoken in near perfect unison, had the ring of repeated ritual.
"When you're older."
Chains raised his eyebrows at Locke and shook his head, ensuring the boy could see the gesture clearly.
"Much older."
"Locke, I don't expect that you know how to set a table." When Locke shook his head, Chains led him over to a tall cabinet just to the left of the cooking hearth. Inside were stacks of white porcelain plates. Chains held one up so Locke could see the hand-painted heraldic design, a mailed fist clutching an arrow and a grapevine, and the bright gold gilding on the rim.
"Borrowed," said Chains, "on a rather permanent basis from Doña Isabella Manichetso, the old dowager aunt of our own Duke Nicovante. She died childless and rarely gave parties, so it wasn't as though she was using them all. You see how some of our acts that might seem purely cruel and larcenous to outsiders are actually sort of convenient, if you look at them in the right way? That's the hand of the benefactor at work, or so we like to think. It's not as though we could tell the difference if he didn't want us to." Chains handed the plate to Locke, who clutched at it with greatly exaggerated care, and peered very closely at the gold rim, and ran his right hand lovingly over the surface of the witchwood table. "Now this used to be the property of Marius Cordo, a master merchant of Tal Verar. He had it in the great cabin of a triple-decker galley. Huge! 86 oars! I was a bit upset with him, so I lifted it, his chairs, his carpets and tapestries, and all of his clothes, right off the ship. I left his money. I was making a point. I dumped everything but the table into the sea of brass. And that," Chains lifted a finger in the direction of the celestial chandelier, "that was being shipped overland from Ashmere in a guarded wagon convoy for the old Don Leviana. Somehow, in transit, it transformed itself into a box of straw." Chains took three more plates out of the cabinet and set them in Locke's arms. "Damn, I was fairly good back when I actually worked for a living." "Urk," said Locke, under the weight of the fine dinnerware. "Oh, yeah." Chains gestured to the chair at the head of the table. "Put one there for me. One for yourself on my left. Two for Carlo and Galdo on my right. If you were my servant, what I'd tell you to lay out is a casual setting. Can you say that for me?"
"A casual setting."
"Right. This is how the high and mighty eat when it's just close blood and maybe a friend or two." Chains let the set of his eyes and the tone of his voice suggest that he expected this lesson to be retained, and he began to introduce Locke to the intricacies of glasses, linen napkins, and silver eating utensils.
"What kind of knife is this?"
Locke held a rounded buttering utensil up for Chains' inspection.
"It's all wrong. You couldn't kill anyone with this."
"Well, not very easily, I'll grant you that, my boy." Chains guided Locke in the placement of the butter knife and assorted small dishes and bowls. "But when the quality get together to dine, it's impolite to knock anybody off with anything but poison. That thing is for scooping butter, not slicing windpipes."
"This is a lot of trouble to go to just to eat."
"Well, in Shades Hill, you may be able to eat cold bacon and dirt pies off one another's asses for all your old master cares. But now you're a gentleman bastard. Emphasis on the gentleman. You're going to learn how to eat like this and how to serve people who eat like this."
"Why?"
"Because, Locke Lamora, someday you're going to dine with barons and counts and dukes. You're going to dine with merchants and admirals and generals and ladies of every sort. And when you do..." Chains put two fingers under Locke's chin and tilted the boy's head up so they were eye to eye. "When you do, those poor idiots won't have any idea that they're really dining with a thief." 3. "Now, isn't this lovely?" Chains raised an empty glass and saluted his three young wards at the splendidly furnished table. Steaming brass bowls and heavy crockware held the results of Carlo and Galdo's efforts at the cooking hearth. Locke, seated on an extra cushion to raise his elbows just above the tabletop, stared at the food and the furnishings with wide eyes.
He was bewildered at how quickly he had escaped his old life and fallen into this new one with strangely pleasant, crazy people. Chains lifted a bottle of something he'd called alchemical wine. The stuff was viscous and dark, like quicksilver. When he pulled the loosened cork, the air was filled with the scent of juniper. For a brief moment, it overwhelmed the spicy aroma of the main dishes. Chains poured a good measure of the stuff into the empty glass, and in the bright light it ran like molten silver. Chains raised the glass to a level with his eyes. "A glass poured to air for the one who sits with us unseen, the patron and protector, the crooked warden, the father of necessary pretexts."
"Thanks for deep pockets poorly guarded," said the Sansa brothers in unison,
and Locke was caught off guard by the seriousness of their intonation.
"Thanks for watchmen asleep at their posts," said Chains.
"Thanks for the city to nurture us and the night to hide us," was the response.
"Thanks for friends to help spend the loot."
Chains brought the half-filled glass down and set it in the middle of the table. He took up another smaller glass. Into this he poured just a finger of the liquid silver.
"A glass poured to air for an absent friend. We wish Sabatha well and pray for her safe return."
"Maybe we could have her back a little less crazy, though," said one of the Sansas, whom Locke mentally labelled Carlo for convenience. "And humble," Galdo nodded after he'd said this. "Humble would be really great."
"The brothers Sansa wish Sabatha well."
Chains held the little glass of liquor rock steady and eyed the twins.
"And they pray for her safe return."
"Yes, wish her well. Safe return, that would be really great."
"Who's Sabatha?" Locke spoke quietly, directing his inquiry to Chains.
"An ornament to our little gang. Our only young woman, currently away on educational business."
Chains set her glass down beside the one poured to the benefactor and plucked up Locke's glass in exchange.
"Another special deal from your old master. Gifted, my boy, gifted like you are with a preternatural talent for the vexation of others."
"That's us he's talking about," said Carlo. "Pretty soon it'll mean you too,"
Galdo smiled.
"Pipe down, twitlings."
Chains poured a splash of the quicksilver wine into Locke's glass and handed it back to him.
"One more toast and prayer. To Locke Lamora, our new brother, my new Pezon. We wish him well. We welcome him warmly. And for him, we pray, wisdom."
With graceful motions, he poured wine for Carlo and Galdo, and then a nearly full glass for himself. Chains and the Sansas raised their glasses. Locke quickly copied them. Silver sparkled under gold.
"Welcome to the gentlemen bastards."
Chains tapped his glass gently against Locke's, producing a ringing sound that hung in the air before fading sweetly.
"You should have picked death," said Galdo. "He did offer you death as a choice, right?"
Carlo spoke as he and his brother tapped their own glasses together, then reached across the table in unison to touch Locke's.
"Laugh it up, boys."
Soon all the knocking about with glasses was finished, and Chains led the way with a quick sip of his wine.
"Ah, mark my words, if this poor little creature lives a year, you two will be his dancing monkeys. He'll throw you grapes whenever he wants to see a trick. Go ahead and have a drink, Locke."
Locke raised the glass. The silvery surface showed him a vivid but wobbly reflection of his own face and the brightly lit room around him. The wine's bouquet was a haze of juniper and anise that tickled his nose. He put the tiny image of himself to his lips and drank. The slightly cool liquor seemed to go two ways at once as he swallowed. A line of tickling warmth ran straight down his throat, while icy tendrils reached upward, sliding across the roof of his mouth and into his sinuses. His eyes bulged. He coughed and ran a hand over his suddenly numb lips. "It's mirror wine from Tal Verar. Good stuff. Now go ahead and eat something, or it'll pop your skull open." Carlo and Galdo whisked damp cloths off serving platters and bowls, revealing the full extent of the meal for the first time. There were indeed sausages, neatly sliced and fried in oil with quartered pears. There were also split red peppers stuffed with almond paste and spinach, dumplings of thin bread folded over chicken, fried until the bread was as translucent as paper, and cold black beans in wine and mustard sauce. The Sansa brothers were suddenly scooping portions of this and that onto Locke's plate, too fast for him to track. Working awkwardly with a two-pronged silver fork and one of the rounded knives he'd previously scorned, Locke began to shovel things into his mouth. The flavors seemed to burst gloriously, haphazardly. The chicken dumplings were spiced with ginger and ground orange peels. The wine sauce in the bean salad warmed his tongue. The sharp fumes of mustard burned his throat. He found himself gulping wine to put out each new fire as it arose. To his surprise, the Sansa twins didn't partake once they'd served him. They sat with their hands folded, watching chains. When the older man seemed assured that Locke was eating, he turned to Carlo. "You're a Vardran noble. Let's say you're a liege graf from one of the less important marrows. You're at a dinner party in Tal Verar. An equal number of men and women with assigned seating. The party is just entering the dining hall. Your assigned lady is beside you as you enter, conversing with you. What do you do?"
"At a Vardran dinner party, I would hold her chair out for her without invitation."
Carlo didn't smile.
"But Ferrari ladies will stand beside a chair to show they want it pulled out. It's impolite to presume, so I'd let her make the first move."
"Very good. Now." Chains pointed to the second Sansa with one hand as he began adding food to his plate with the other. "What's 17 multiplied by 19? Galdo closed his eyes in concentration for a few seconds.
323.
"Correct. What's the difference between a Vardran nautical league and a Therin nautical league?"
The Vardran league is 150 yards longer."
"Very good. That's that, then. Go and eat." As the Sansa brothers began to undecorously struggle for possession of certain serving dishes, Chains turned to Locke, whose plate was already half empty. "After you've been here a few days, I'm going to start asking questions about what you've learned, too. If you want to eat, you'll be expected to learn."
"What am I going to learn, other than setting tables?"
"Everything." Chains looked very pleased with himself. "Everything, my boy. How to fight, how to steal, how to lie with a straight face, how to cook meals like this, how to disguise yourself, how to speak like a noble, how to scribe like a priest, how to skulk like a half-wit."
"Carlo already knows that one," said Galdo. "Armo agna mabra," said Carlo around a mouthful of food.
"Remember what I said when I told you we didn't work like other thieves work? We're a new sort of thief here, Locke. What we are is actors, false facers. I sit here and pretend to be a priest of Perelandro. For years now, people have been throwing money at me. How do you think I paid to furnish this little fairy burrow, this food? I'm 53. Nobody my age can steal around rooftops and charm locks. I'm better paid for being blind than I ever was for being quick and clever. And now I'm too slow and too round to pass for anything really interesting." Chains finished off the contents of his glass and poured another. "But you and Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha, you four will have every advantage I didn't. Your education will be thorough and vigorous. I'll refine my notions, my techniques. When I'm finished, the things you four will pull
Well, they'll make my little scam with this temple look simple and unambitious.
That sounds nice, said Locke, who was feeling the wine.
A warm haze of charitable contentment was descending over him, and smothering the tension and worry that was so second nature to a Shades Hill orphan.
What do we do first?
Well, tonight, if you're not busy throwing up the first decent meal you've ever had, Carlo and Galdo will draw you a bath. Once you're less aromatic company, you can sleep in. Tomorrow, we'll get you an acolyte's robe, and you can sit the steps with us, taking coins. Tomorrow night, Chains scratched at his beard while he took a sip from his glass, I take you to meet the big man, Kappa Barsavi. He's ever so curious to get a look at you. Chapter 3 Imaginary Men 1 For the second time in 2 days, Don Lorenzo Salvara found his life interrupted by masked and hooded strangers in an unexpected place. This time it was just after midnight, and they were waiting for him in his study.
"Close the door,"
said the shorter intruder. His voice was all Camorre, rough and smoky, and clearly accustomed to being obeyed.
"Have a seat, my lord, and don't bother calling for your man. He is indisposed."
"Who the hell are you?"
Salvara's sword hand curled reflexively. His belt held no scabbard. He slid the door closed behind him, but made no move to sit at his writing desk.
"How did you get in here?"
The intruder who'd first spoken reached up and pulled down the black cloth that covered his nose and mouth. His face was lean and angular, his hair black, his dark moustache thin and immaculately trimmed. A white scar arced across the man's right cheekbone. He reached into the folds of his well-cut black cloak and pulled out a black leather wallet, which he flipped open so the Don could see its contents, a small crest of gold set inside an intricate design of frosted glass.
"Gods!"
Don Salvara fell into his chair nervously, without further hesitation.
"You're Midnighters!"
"Just so."
The man folded his wallet and put it back in his cloak. The silent intruder, still masked and hooded, moved casually around to stand just a few feet behind Don Lorenzo, between him and the door.
"We apologize for the intrusion, but our business here is extremely sensitive."
Have I somehow offended his grace?"
"Not to my knowledge, my lord Salvara. In fact, you might say we're here to help prevent you from doing so."
What did you say you did to Conte?"
"Just gave him a little something to help him sleep. We know he's loyal, and we know he's dangerous. We didn't want any misunderstandings."
The man standing at the door punctuated this statement by stepping forward, reaching around Don Salvara, and gently setting Conte's matching fighting knives down on the desktop.
"I see. I trust that he'll be well."
Don Salvara drummed his fingers on his writing desk and stared at the scarred intruder.
"I should be very displeased otherwise."
"He is completely unharmed. I give you my word as the Duke's man."
"I shall hold that sufficient, for the time being."
The scarred man sighed and rubbed his eyes with 2 gloved fingers.
"There's no need for us to begin like this, my lord. I apologize for the abruptness of our appearance and the manner of our intrusion, but I believe you'll find that your welfare is paramount in our master's eyes. I'm instructed to ask, did you enjoy yourself at the revel today?"
"Yes."
Don Salvara spoke carefully, as though to a solicitor or a court recorder. "I suppose that would be an accurate assessment."
"Good, good. You had company, didn't you?"
"The Doña Sofia was with me."
"I refer to someone else, not one of His Grace's subjects, not Camorre."
"Ah,
the merchant, a merchant named Lucas Fairwhite from Emberlane.
From Emberlane, of course.
The scarred man folded his arms and looked around the Don's study. He stared for a moment at a pair of small glass portraits of the old Don and Doña Salvara, set in a frame decked with black velvet funeral ribbons.
Well, that man is no more a merchant of Emberlane than you or I, my lord Salvara. He's a fraud, a sham.
Don Salvara nearly jumped to his feet, but remembered the man standing behind him and seemed to think better of it. I don't see how that could be possible.
Beg pardon, my lord.
The scarred man smiled, gruesomely and artificially, as a man without children might smile when trying to comfort an upset babe.
But let me ask you, have you ever heard of the man they call the Thorn of Camor?
2.
I only steal because my dear old family needs the money to live.
Locke Lamora made this proclamation with his wineglass held high. He and the other gentleman bastards were seated at the old witchwood table in the opulent burrow beneath the house of Perelandro. Carlo and Galdo on his right, Jean and Bug on his left. A huge spread of food was set before them, and the celestial chandelier swung overhead with its familiar golden light. The others began to jeer.
"Liar!" they chorused in unison. "I only steal because this wicked world won't let me work an honest trade," Carlo cried, hoisting his own glass. "Liar! I only steal because I have to support my poor lazy twin brother, whose indolence broke our mother's heart,"
Galdo elbowed Carlo as he made this announcement.
"Liar!
I only steal," said Jean, "because I've temporarily fallen in with bad company."
"Liar!"
At last the ritual came to Bug. The boy raised his glass a bit shakily and yelled,
"I only steal because it's heaps of fucking fun!"
"Bastard!"
With a general clamour of whooping and hollering, the five thieves banged glasses together. Light glittered on crystal and shone through the misty green depths of Verari mint wine. The four men drained their glasses in one go and slammed them back down on the tabletop. Bug, already a bit cross-eyed, handled his somewhat more delicately.
"Gentlemen, I hold in my hands the first fruits of all our long weeks of study and suffering."
Locke held up a rolled parchment embossed with ribbons and a blue wax seal, the colour of the lesser nobility of Camor.
"A letter of credit for 5,000 full crowns, to be drawn tomorrow against Don Salvara's funds at Maraggio's, and, I dare say, the first score our youngest member has ever helped us to bring in." "Barrel boy!"
the Sansa brothers hollered in unison. A moment later a small almond-crusted bread roll arced from between their seats, hit Bug right between the eyes, and plopped down onto his empty plate. Bug tore it in half and responded in kind, aiming well despite his wobbliness. Locke continued, speaking as Carlo scowled and rubbed crumbs out of his eyes.
"Second touch this afternoon was easy, but we wouldn't have gotten so far so fast if not for Bug's quick action yesterday. What a stupid, reckless, idiotic, ridiculous damn thing to do! I haven't the words to express my admiration."
Locke had managed to work a bit of wine bottle legerdemain while speaking. The empty glasses were suddenly full.
"To Bug, the new bane of the Camor City Watch!"
When the cheering and the guzzling from this toast had subsided, and Bug had been smacked upon the back often enough to turn the contents of his skull sideways, Locke produced a single large glass, set it in the middle of the table, and filled it slowly.
"Just one thing more before we can eat."
He held the glass up as the others fell silent.
"A glass poured to air for an absent friend. We miss old Chains terribly, and we wish his soul peace. May the crooked warden ever stand watch and bless his crooked servant.
He was a good and penitent man in the manner of our kind. Gently, Locke set the glass in the centre of the table and covered it with a small black cloth. He would have been very proud of you, Bug.
I do hope so.
The boy stared at the covered glass in the middle of the opulent glassware and gilded cookery.
I wish I could have met him.
You would have been a restful project for his old age. Jean kissed the back of his own left hand, the benedictory gesture of the nameless 13th's priesthood. A very welcome respite from what he endured raising the four of us.
Jean's being generous. He and I were saints. It's the sons of brothers that kept the poor old bastard up late praying 6 nights out of 7.
Locke reached out toward one cloth-covered platter.
Let's eat. Praying that you and Jean would grow up quick and handsome like the two of us, you mean?
Galdo's hand darted out and caught Locke's at the wrist.
Aren't you forgetting something?
Am I? Carlo, Galdo, and Jean met this question with a coordinated stare. Bug looked sheepish and gazed up at the chandelier.
God's damn it!
Locke slid out of his gold-gilded chair and went to a side cupboard. When he returned to the table, he had a tiny sampling glass in his hand, little more than a thimble for liquor. Into this he let slip the smallest dash of mint wine. He didn't hold his glass up, but pushed it into the center of the table beside the glass under the black cloth.
A glass poured in air for an absent someone. I don't know where she is at the moment, and I pray you all choke, save Bug. Thanks very fucking much. Hardly a graceful blessing, especially for a priest.
Carlo kissed the back of his own left hand and waved it over the tiny glass.
She was one of us even before you were, Garista.
You know what I do pray? Locke set his hands on the edge of the table, his knuckles rapidly turning white.
That maybe some day one of you finds out what love is when it travels farther up than the buttons of your trousers. It takes two to break a heart.
Galdo gently placed his left hand over Locke's right.
I don't recall her fucking things up without your able assistance. And I dare say, said Carlo, that it would be a tremendous relief to us all if you would just have the courtesy to go out and get yourself wenched, long and hard. Gods, do three at once. It's not as though we don't have the funds. I'll have you know my patience for this topic was exhausted long before...
Locke's voice was rising to a shout when Jean grabbed him firmly by his left biceps. Jean's fist wrapped easily all the way around Locke's arm.
She was our good friend, Locke. Was and still is. You owe her something a bit more godly than that.
Jean reached out for the wine bottle, then filled the little glass to its brim. He raised it into the light and took his other hand off Locke's arm.
A glass poured to air for an absent friend. We wish Sabbatha well. For ourselves we pray brotherhood.
Locke stared at him for a second that seemed like minutes, then let out a long sigh.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to ruin the occasion. That was a poor toast, and I repented. I should have thought better of my responsibilities.
I'm sorry, too.
Galdo grinned sheepishly.
We don't blame you for the way you feel. We know she was...
her...
Well, I'm not sorry about the wenching bit.
Carlo shrugged in mock apology.
I'm fucking serious, man. Dip your wick. Drop your anchor. Go see a lady about a sheath for a dagger. You'll feel better.
Isn't it obvious that I'm just ecstatic right now? I don't need to feel better, because you and I still have work to do this evening. For the love of the crooked warden, can we please just kill this subject and throw its godsdamned corpse in the bay?
Sorry, Carlo said after a few seconds and a well-aimed glare from Jean. Sorry. Look, you know we mean well. We're both sorry if we push. But she's in parley and we're in Camor, and it's obvious you...
Carlo would have said something else, but an almond roll bounced off the bridge of his nose, and he flinched in surprise. Another roll hit Galdo in the forehead. One arced into Jean's lap, and Locke managed to throw up a hand in time to swat down the one intended for him.
"Honestly!"
Bug clutched still more rolls in his outstretched hands, and he pointed them like loaded crossbows.
"Is this what I get to look forward to when I grow up? I thought we were celebrating being richer and cleverer than everyone else."
Locke looked at the boy for just a moment, then reached out and took the full sampling glass from Jean, a smile breaking out as he did so.
"Bug's right. Let's cut the shit and have dinner."
He raised the glass as high as he could toward the light of the chandelier.
"To us, richer and cleverer than everyone else." "Richer and cleverer than everyone else," came the echoing chorus. "We toast absent friends who helped to bring us to where we are now. We do miss them."
Locke set the little glass to his lips and took a minuscule sip before he set it back down.
"And we love them still," he added quietly.
3. The Thorn of Camor. It's a particularly ridiculous rumor that floats around the dining parlor when some of the more excitable dons don't water their wine quite thoroughly enough.
"The Thorn of Camor," said the scarred man pleasantly, "walked off your pleasure barge early this evening with a signed note for 5,000 of your white iron crowns."
"Who? Lucas Fairwhite?"
"None other."
"Lucas Fairwhite is a Vadran. My mother was Vadran. I know the tongue. Lucas is old Emberlane all the way through. He covers himself in wool and flinches back 6 feet any time a woman blinks at him."
Don Lorenzo pulled his optics off in irritation and set them on his desk. "The man would bet the lives of his own children against the price he could get for barrels of herring guts on any given morning. I've dealt with his kind too many times to count. That man is no Camori, and he is no mythical thief."
"My lord, you are 24, yes?"
"For the time being, is that quite relevant?"
"You have no doubt known many merchants in the years since your mother and father passed away. May they have the peace of the long silence. Many merchants, and many of them Vadrans, correct?"
"Quite correct."
"And if a man, a very clever man, wishes you to think him a merchant, well, what would he dress up and present himself as? A fisherman? A mercenary archer?"
"I don't grasp your meaning."
"I mean, my lord Salvara, that your own expectations have been used against you. You have a keen sense for men of business, surely. You've grown your family fortune several times over in your brief time handling it. Therefore, a man who wished to snare you in some scheme could do nothing wiser than to act the consummate man of business, to deliberately manifest all of your expectations, to show you exactly what you expected and desired to see."
"It seems to me that if I accept your argument," the Don said slowly, "then the self-evident truth of any legitimate thing could be taken as grounds for its falseness. I say Lucas Fairwhite is a merchant of Emberlane because he shows the signs of being so. You say those same signs are what prove him counterfeit. I need more sensible evidence than this."
"Let me digress then, my lord, and ask another question."
The scarred man drew his hands within the black folds of his cloak and stared down at the young nobleman.
"If you were a thief who preyed exclusively on the nobility of our serene Duchy of Camor, how would you hide your actions?"
"Exclusively? Your Thorn of Camor again. There can't be any such thief. There are arrangements, the secret peace. Other thieves would take care of the matter as soon as any man dared breach the peace."
And if our thief could evade capture, if our thief could conceal his identity from his fellows?
If, they say the Thorn of Camor steals from the rich. Don Salvara placed a hand on his own chest, and gives every last copper to the poor. But have you heard of any bags of gold being dumped in the street in Catch Fire lately? Any charcoal burners or knackers suddenly walking around in silk waistcoats and embroidered boots? Please, the Thorn is a commoner's ale tale. Master swordsman, romancer of ladies, a ghost who walks through walls. Ridiculous!
Your doors are locked and all your windows are barred. Yet here we are in your study, my lord.
Granted, but you're men of flesh and blood.
So it's said. We're getting off the subject. Our thief, my lord, would trust you and your peers to keep his activities concealed for him. Hypothetically speaking, if Lucas Fairwhite were the Thorn of Camor, and you knew that he had strolled off with a small fortune from your coffers, what would you do? Would you rouse the watch, cry for aid openly in the court of his grace, speak of the matter in front of Don Paleri Jacopo?
That's an interesting point. I wonder...
Would you want the entire city to know that you'd been taken in? That you'd been tricked? Would men of business ever trust your judgment again? Would your reputation ever truly recover?
I suppose it would be a very difficult thing. The scarred man's right hand reappeared, gloveless and pale against the darkness of the cloak, one finger pointing outward.
Her ladyship, the Doña Rosalina de Mare, lost 10,000 crowns 4 years ago in exchange for titles to upriver orchards that don't exist.
A second finger curled outward.
Don and Doña Felucia lost twice as much 2 years ago. They thought they were financing a coup in Talisham that would have made the city a family estate. Last year, the scarred man said as a third finger unfolded, Don Javariz paid 15,000 full crowns to a soothsayer who claimed to be able to restore the old man's firstborn son to life.
The man's little finger snapped out, and he waved his extended hand at Don Lorenzo.
Now we have the Don and Doña Salvara involved in a secret business deal that is both tempting and convenient. Tell me, have you ever heard of the troubles of the lords and ladies I have named?
No.
Doña de Mare visits your wife in her garden twice weekly. They discuss alchemical botany together. You've played cards with the sons of Don Javaris many times, and yet this is all a surprise to you?
Yes, quite, I assure you.
It was a surprise to His Grace as well. My master has spent 4 years attempting to follow the slender threads of evidence connecting these crimes, my lord. A fortune the size of your own vanished into thin air. And it took ducal orders to pry open the lips of the wronged parties, because their pride compelled their silence.
Don Lorenzo stared at the surface of his desk for a long moment. Fairwhite has a suite at the Tumble Home. He has a manservant, superior clothes, 100-crown optics. He has proprietary secrets of the House of Bel-Oster. Don Salvara looked up at the scarred man as though presenting a difficult problem to a demanding tutor. Things that no thief could have.
Would fine clothes be beyond the means of a man with more than 40,000 stolen crowns at his command? And his cask of unaged brandy? How would you or I or any other man outside the House of Bel-Oster know what it should look like? Or what it should taste like? It's a simple fraud.
He was recognized on the street by a solicitor,
one of the Razona law scribes who sticks to the walls at Maraggio's.
Of course he was, because he began building the identity of Lucas Fairwhite long ago, probably before he ever met Doña Damare. He has a very real account at Maraggio's, opened with real money 5 years ago. He has every outward flourish that a man in his position should bear. But Lucas Fairwhite is a ghost, a lie, a stage role performed for a very select private audience. I have tracked him for months.
We are sensible people, Sophia and I. Surely we would have seen something out of place.
Out of place? The entire affair has been out of place. My Lord Salvara, I implore you, hear me carefully. You are a financier of fine liquors. You say a prayer to your mother's shade each week at a Vadran temple. What a fascinating coincidence that you should chance upon a needy Vadran who happens to be a dealer in the same field, eh?
Where else but the Temple of Fortunate Waters would a Vadran pray while visiting Camor?
Nowhere, of course. But look at the coincidences piling heavily upon one another. A Vadran liquor merchant in need of rescue, and he just so happens to be on his way to visit Don Jacobo, your blood enemy, a man that everyone knows you would crush by any means the Duke hadn't forbidden you.
Were you observing us when I first met him?
Yes, very carefully. We saw you and your man approach that alley to rescue a man you thought to be in danger. We
thought he was being strangled.
Was he? The men in those masks were his accomplices, my lord. The fight was staged. It was a means to introduce you to the imaginary merchant and his imaginary opportunity. Everything you value was used to bait the trap. Your sympathies for Vadrans, your sense of duty, your courage, your interest in fine liquors, your desire to best Don Jacobo. And can it be a coincidence that Fairwhite's scheme must be secret? That it runs on an extremely short and demanding schedule? That it just happens to feed your every known ambition?
The Don stared at the far wall of his study, tapping his fingers against his desk at a gradually increasing tempo.
"This is quite a shock,"
he said at last, in a small voice without any fight left in it.
"Forgive me for that, my Lord Salvara. The truth is unfortunate. Of course the Thorn of Camor isn't 10 feet tall. Of course he can't walk through walls. But he is a very real thief. He is posing as a Vadran named Lucas Fairwhite, and he does have 5,000 crowns of your money, with an eye for 20,000 more.
I must send men to Maraggio's, so he can't exchange my note in the morning, said Don Lorenzo.
Respectfully, my lord, you must do nothing of the sort. My instructions are clear. We don't just want the Thorn. We want his accomplices, his contacts, his sources of information, his entire network of thieves and spies. We have him in the open now, and we can follow him as he goes about his business. One hint that his game is unmasked, and he will bolt. The opportunity we have may never present itself again. His Grace Duke Nicovante is quite adamant that everyone involved in these crimes must be identified and taken. Toward that end, your absolute cooperation is requested and required in the Duke's name.
What am I to do, then?
Continue to act as though you are entirely taken in by Fairwhite's story. Let him exchange the note. Let him taste some success. And when he returns to you asking for more money...
Yes?
Why, give it to him, my lord. Give him everything he asks.
4. Once the dinner dishes were cleared away, and a tipsy bug was given the task of setting them a-sparkle with warm water and white sand, "Excellent for your moral education," Jean had cried as he'd heaped up the porcelain and crystal. Locke and Carlo withdrew to the burrow's wardrobe to begin preparations for the third and most critical touch of the Don Salvara game. The elderglass cellar beneath the house of Perelandro was divided into three areas. One of them was the kitchen, another was split into sleeping quarters with wooden partitions, and the third was referred to as the wardrobe. Long clothes racks stretched across every wall of the wardrobe, holding hundreds of pieces of costuming organized by origin, by season, by cut, by size, and by social class. There were sackcloth robes, laborer's tunics, and butcher's aprons with dried bloodstains. There were cloaks of winter weight and summer weight, cheaply woven and finely tailored, unadorned or decorated with everything up to precious metal trim and peacock feathers. There were robes and accessories for most of the Therin priestly orders, Perelandro, Morgante, Nara, Sendovani, Yono, and so forth. There were silk blouses and cunningly armored doublets, gloves and ties and cravats, enough canes and walking sticks to outfit a mercenary company of hobbled old men. Chains had started this collection more than 20 years before, and his students had added to it with the wealth gained from years of schemes. Very little worn by the gentleman bastards went to waste. Even the foulest-smelling, sweat-soaked summer garments were washed and dusted with alchemical pomanders and hung carefully. They could always be fouled up again, if needed. A man-height looking-glass dominated the heart of the wardrobe. Another, much smaller glass, hung from a sort of pulley system on the ceiling, so that it could be moved around and positioned as necessary. Locke stood before the larger mirror dressed in matching doublet and breeches of midnight velvet. His hose was the scarlet of blood in sunset waters, and his simple Camori tie was a near match.
"Is this bloody melodrama really such a good idea?"
Carlo was dressed quite similarly, though his hose and his accents were grey. He pulled his tunic sleeves back above his elbows and fastened them there with black pearl clips.
"It's a fine idea," Locke said, adjusting his tie. "We're midnighters. We're full of ourselves. What sort of self-respecting spy would break into a manor house in darkest night wearing green or orange or white? The sort that walked up and knocked at the door would.
I appreciate that, but I still don't want to change the plan. Don Salvara's had a busy day. He'll be wide open for a nice shock at the end of it. Can't shock him quite the same in lavender and carmine."
"Well, certainly not in the way you're thinking, no."
"This doublet's damned uncomfortable in the back," Locke muttered.
"Jean! Jean!"
"What is it?"
came an echoing return shout a long moment later.
"Why, I'd just love to say your name. Get in here."
Jean ambled into the wardrobe a moment later, a glass of brandy in one hand and a battered book in the other.
"I thought Graumann had the night off for this bit," he said.
"He does."
Locke gestured impatiently at the back of his doublet.
"I need the services of Camor's ugliest seamstress."
Galdo's helping Bug wash up.
"Grab your needles, glass eyes."
Jean's eyebrows drew down above his reading optics, but he set down his book and his glass and opened a small wooden chest set against one of the wardrobe walls.
"What are you reading?"
Carlo had added a tiny silver and amethyst clip to the center of his tie and was examining himself in the small glass approvingly.
"Kim Larvin,"
Jean replied, working black thread through a white bone needle and trying not to prick his fingers.
"The Corish romances?"
Locke snorted.
"Sentimental crap. Never knew you had a taste for fairy stories."
"They happen to be culturally significant records of the Therin throne centuries," Jean said, as he stepped behind Locke, seam ripper in one hand and threaded needle in the other. "Plus at least 3 knights get their heads torn completely off by the beast of Huatzo."
"Illustrated manuscript, by chance?"
"Not the good parts, no.
Jean fiddled with the back of the doublet as delicately as he'd ever charmed a lock or a victim's coat pocket.
"Oh, just let it out. I don't care how it looks. It'll be hidden in the back of my cloak anyway. We can pretty it up later."
"We?" Jean snorted as he loosened the doublet with a few strategic rips and slashes. "Me, more like. You mend clothes like dogs write poetry." "And I readily admit it. Oh, God's much better. Now there's room to hide the sigil wallet and a few surprises, just in case."
"It feels odd to be letting something out for you rather than taking it in."
Jean arranged his tools as he'd found them in the sewing chest and closed it back up.
"Do mind your training. We wouldn't want you gaining half a pound."
"Well, most of me is brain weight." Locke folded his own tunic sleeves back and pinned them up as Carlo had.
"You're one-third bad intentions, one-third pure avarice, and one-eighth sawdust. What's left, I'll credit, must be brains."
"Well, since you're here and you're such an expert on my poor self, why don't you pull out the mask box and help me with my face?"
Jean paused for a sip from his brandy glass before pulling out a tall, battered wooden box inset with many dozens of small drawers.
"What do we want to do first? Your hair? You're going black, right?"
"As pitch. I should only have to be this fellow two or three times."
Jean twirled a white cloth around the shoulders of Locke's doublet and fastened it in front with a tiny bone clasp. He then opened a poultice jar and smeared his fingers with the contents, a firm dark gel that smelled richly of citrus.
Looks like charcoal and smells like oranges. I'll never fathom Jessaline's sense of humour."
Locke smiled as Jean began to knead the stuff into his brown hair.
"Even a black apothecary needs to stay amused somehow. Remember that beef-scented knockout candle she gave us to deal with Don Felucia's damn guard dog?"
"Very droll, that." Carlo frowned as he made further minute adjustments to his own finery.
"Stray cats running from every corner of Camor at the scent, dropping in their tracks until the street was full of little bodies. Wind shifting all over the place, and all of us running around trying to stay ahead of the smoke."
"Not our finest moment," said Jean. His job was already nearly finished. The stuff seemed to sink into Locke's hair, imparting a natural-looking shade of deep Camori black, with only the slightest sheen. But many men in Camor used slick substances to hold or perfume their hair. This would hardly be noteworthy.
Jean wiped his fingers on Locke's white neck towel, then dipped a scrap of cloth into another poultice jar containing a pearly gel. This stuff, when applied to his fingers, cleared the residue of hair dye away as though the black gel were evaporating into thin air.
Jean dabbed the cloth at Locke's temples and neck, erasing the faint smudges and drips left over from the colouring process.
"Scar?" Jean asked when he was finished.
"Please." Locke ran his little finger across the line of his right cheekbone. "Slash right across there, if you would."
Jean withdrew a slender wooden tube with a chalky white tip from the mask box and drew a short line on Locke's face with it, just as Locke had indicated.
Locke flinched as the stuff sizzled for a second or two. In the blink of an eye, the white line hardened into a raised, pale arc of pseudo-skin, perfectly mimicking a scar.
Bug appeared through the wardrobe door at that instant, his cheeks a bit ruddier than usual. In one hand he held a black leather folding wallet, slightly larger than that which a gentleman would ordinarily carry.
"Kitchen's clean. Galdo said you'd forget this if I didn't bring it in and throw it at you."
"Please don't take him literally."
Locke held out a hand for the wallet while Jean removed the white cloth from his shoulders, satisfied that the hair dye was dry.
"Break that thing and I'll roll you to Emberlane in a barrel, personally."
The sigil inside the wallet, the intricate confection of gold and crystal and frosted glass, was by far the most expensive prop of the whole game. Even the 502 cask of Osterschalin had been cheaper. The sigil had been crafted in Talisham, 4 days' ride down the coast to the south. No Camori counterfeiter, regardless of skill, could be trusted to be quiet or comfortable about mimicking the badge of the Duke's own secret police. A stylized spider over the royal seal of the Serene Duchy. None of the gentleman bastards had ever seen one, but Locke was confident that few of the lesser nobility had either. The rough description of the dreaded sigil was whispered by the right people of Camor, and from that description a best-guess forgery had been put together.
"Durant the Gimp says that the spider's just bullshit," said Bug as he handed over the wallet.
All three older gentleman bastards in the room looked at him sharply.
"If you put Durant's brains in a thimbleful of water," said Jean, "they'd look like a ship lost in the middle of the sea."
"The Midnighters are real, Bug." Locke patted his hair gingerly and found that his hands came away clean.
"If you're ever found breaching the peace, you'd better pray the Kappa gets to you before they do. Barsavi's the soul of mercy compared to the man that runs the Palace of Patience."
"I know the Midnighters are real," said Bug. "I just said there's some that say the spider is bullshit."
"Oh, he exists. Jean, pick out a moustache for me. Something that goes with this hair." Locke ran a finger over the smooth skin around his lips, shaved just after dinner.
"There's a man behind the Midnighters. Jean and I have spent years trying to figure out which of the Duke's court it must be, but all the leads go nowhere in the end."
"Even Galdo and I are stumped," added Carlo. "So you know we're dealing with a devil of singular subtlety." "How can you be sure, though?"
"Let me put it like this, Bug."
Locke paused while Jean held up a false moustache. Locke shook his head and Jean went back to digging in the mask box.
"When Kappa Barsavi does for someone, we hear about it, right? We have connections and the word gets passed. The Kappa wants people to know his reasons. It avoids future trouble, makes an example."
"And when the Duke does for someone himself," said Carlo, "there's always signs. Yellow jackets, night glass soldiers, writs, trials, proclamations."
"But when the spider puts the finger on someone..."
Locke gave a brief nod of approval to the second moustache Jean held up for consideration.
"When it's the spider, the poor bastard in question falls right off the face of the world, and Kappa Barsavi doesn't say a thing. Do you understand? He pretends that nothing has happened. So when you grasp that Barsavi doesn't fear the Duke, looks down on him quite a bit, actually, well, it follows that there's someone out there who does make him wet his breeches."
"Oh,"